Welcome to our interview, Zach. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be here.
Yeah. So, as your name perhaps hasn't reached all mainstream readers and listeners out there yet, can you perhaps introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your background?
My name is Zach Voorhees. I've been a Google engineer for 8.5 years. Three of those years I worked at YouTube, which is owned by Google. And recently I decided to come out and blow the whistle on Google's massive censorship regime that they've been using against the American public, and how they're interfering in elections not only in the United States, but around the world. And this information that I've released consists of 950 pages of internal documents detailing the censorship regime.
Mm-hmm. We can just go through a bit more about your background first, perhaps. What's your educational background?
My educational background is I've got an undergraduate degree in Bachelor of Science with majors in psychology, computer science, and mathematics. So I'm a triple major.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated in 2016 at the University of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. What is your career background before Google, and how came you started to work for Google?
I used to work for the game industry. I worked at Lucasfilm doing the Indiana Jones and Star Wars games. And then I went over to Google as a career upgrade in the Bay Area, and I started working. My first project with Google was Google Earth. And then after Google Earth, I went on to YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a bit curious about this transaction between Google and YouTube. How came you move to YouTube, actually?
Well, YouTube is completely owned by Google. And the time that I worked at Google was split up into two parts. So the first part, I worked for Google Earth for 5.5 years, starting from 2008 to 2000 and ending in 2013. I then started my own company called Zachy's, and we sell the best bicycle glove the world has ever seen. It's got a turn signal on the back of the hand, and the website's called Zachy's.com. In fact, it's still going. But I returned to the private sector, or the corporate sector, returning back to Google, and then I was given a choice of where I wanted to work. And I ended up choosing this job with YouTube, and the team that I worked with was called the Cobalt team, and we were responsible for taking the YouTube embedded app and placing it on every single television and game console in the world. And so I worked on the game consoles PlayStation 4, Nintendo Switch, and Xbox One.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever someone uses one of those consoles to access YouTube, that's the app that I helped work on.
Do you mainly work with UI, or perhaps background programming, how this embedded functionality works, or what's your specialty?
I do embedded C++. So it's these little embedded devices that run, you know, system software. Is the best way to do it. I don't do back end. I don't do databases. I do like front end, like the rendering of data.
Mm-hmm. Just curious to know also about Google and YouTube. YouTube is, as you said, it's owned by Google. But what more difference do you see, like, between Google and YouTube? Can you describe for us how is it to work within these two companies? Do they have different headquarters? Is there anything else that is very different between these two companies?
YouTube is completely owned by Google, and internally, there's not a lot of difference between the two entities. We use all the same software. We use G Suite, which is the Google Docs sort of enterprise software, to run the company, and that's very much similar. We have we all join in on the same weekly meetings that the CEOs have with the rest of the company called TGIF. The only thing that's really different is the fact that YouTube has some special all hands, all employees meetings that Google doesn't have. So it's like essentially Google plus our own sort of team direction. But other than that, it's pretty much Google all the way through.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the two CEOs, they're pretty tight with each other.
Well, yeah. So the CEO of YouTube is Susan Wojcicki, and her sister is actually married to the former CEO of Google. So, and so there's that that really close family relationship.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, your picture of the two companies is that they work very close to each other. I mean, there is no like friction or so between these two.
YouTube is Google.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what's the culture working inside Google and YouTube? I mean, talking about like social events and how's the atmosphere in general compared to maybe other tech companies and so on. How would you describe it before this political era begins and all the other things that we are coming to later in the interview? But how is it to work at Google?
Right. So prior to 2016, working at Google was really great. It's pretty much the dream job that everyone wishes that they had. Free lunch, good work-life balance, free dinner, free breakfast, and this liberal, like, express yourself, the data matters, the expression of the users matters. That's what Google meant to us. After Trump won the election in 2016, then everything changed. The company did a complete 180-degree change, and they decided that instead of putting the user first, what they were going to do is they were going to try to protect everyone from fake news. Mm-hmm. And so they took that radical diversion, and they started acting as a censor. And so I really break it up into two parts, the time before Trump won and then the time after Trump won. After Trump won, things started to go downhill, and things started to get scary.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for example, about political discussions, how did they differ, comparing 2016 to now? I mean, I'm talking about between employees. How has the climate changed within the company, you would say?
How has the climate changed? So before, you could actually say anything that you wanted, more or less, within the political discussion boards that Google had, which were basically email lists. But then after Trump won, there started to become this growing intolerance towards conservative thought. And people started being targeted and harassed and then called out and then doxed. And things started to have a chilling sort of effect. People were afraid to speak out. And many of the discussion boards, like Republican and conservative, were like locked down so that only the members themselves could see what was being said, and the outside world couldn't, you know, all the lefties couldn't come in and see what we were discussing, because we knew that they would seek to use whatever they could at their disposal to out some of the conservatives. We didn't know when it was going to happen, but some people were targeted and placed on leave based upon arguments that they were getting into that were searched by other employees within the company.
Interesting. I guess, as I understand from other interviews, you have told that there are other people within Google that is still there that have the same kind of concerns as you. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a network of people that don't like what Google's doing, and they're scared of what Google has become, and they don't want to speak out because a lot of them are married and have children, and they don't want to put everything on the line to make a stand, but they don't like what's happening, and they're just laying low.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, after you went public in Project Veritas and leaked these documents, Do you know, are you aware of anything that Google changed after this leak? I mean, externally or internally? Have you heard anything? Maybe they closed something down?
Yeah, the only thing that they've done that I've seen is that they've closed down political discussion within the company. As far as, you know, so Project Veritas revealed to the public that one of the executives, Jen Janai, admitted on camera in an undercover sting that only something the size of Google could prevent the next Trump situation in 2020. Mm-hmm. And instead of Jen Janai being fired or the company distancing themselves from her comments, the company instead actually protected her. And they are showing that they have no willingness to change or make corrections or admit their own fault in any of this. In fact, they're acting like it's still a conspiracy theory that they're trying to influence the election despite the overwhelming evidence. So has Google changed? Not in any way that seems to be positive. They seem to be doubling down.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you, for example, on Medium.com, you wrote an article showing that they are trying to hide some of the search predictions, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so for example, these kind of things that you can see as a user, do you think that they have you seen any such things that they have changed after your disclosure? I mean, are they trying to hide anything now to not make it obvious? Do you understand?
Everything is obvious and everything is still obvious. We've looked at a number of search queries, including Clinton body count and Trump body count and men can and what it auto-completes there. And it's still auto-completing in ways that it was 3 months ago. So nothing has changed. They haven't made any course correction. Despite all the rage, they're still trying to put us in a cage.
Mm-hmm. So we have heard from Professor Robert Epstein that he's now setting up a larger kind of a machine to monitor Google for the next election. So what do you think about the possibilities for a success with his project? Is it? Do you think Google will be able to cover such up, or do you think that we will actually be able to caught Google during this election interference?
Yes, they're going to be able to see what Google is doing, but really, this isn't just like a political fight on television. This is really a cultural moment. And the way that we catch Google is that, you know, we become aware, we activate people, we see what they're doing, and we call them out on Twitter in real time as the election results are, well, as the election is meddled with. I don't think at this point that Google is going to stop their behavior unless forced to by law. I believe that they're going to continue, and I believe that Robert Epstein's project is a step in the right direction. It's going to let us know what we already know, that Google's intending to meddle in these elections, but it's going to show us how they're doing it specifically, and that's a really great step in the direction that we need to be in.
Mm-hmm. I think in the from the leaked documents, you said that you handed over them to the DOJ. So I guess you already can point out something that you think is not just immoral but illegal. Can you tell us what specifically in these documents that Google is doing now that is would maybe be considered illegal by the government?
Mm-hmm. So there was a breaking point that I had, and the breaking point for me was when I discovered that Google was deleting words out of their Arabic translation dictionary in order to make a Trump tweet sound crazy. And so if you go back to May 2017, Donald Trump went to Saudi Arabia. He returned on May 25th, and he tweeted out the following: despite the negative constant press, kefefe. Well, people online figured out what this word kefefe meant, and they said, hey, look, Google Translate is translating kefefe into we will stand up. So you put the whole thing together, and it says, you know, despite the negative constant press, we will stand up. That's actually really cool, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the New York Times decided that they were going to run a hit piece saying, no, 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 actually, this isn't the way that the word is. And they got some, you know, Middle Eastern studies person in one of these ivory tower, like, educational institutions. Maybe it was Harvard, maybe it was Yale. I'm not entirely sure. But this person said that, oh, yeah, kafefe, it means nothing, right? It's absolutely nonsense. So the New York Times prints out that, no, kafefe actually means nonsense. And as a result, one of the executive directors at Google created a design doc that said, hey, look, this word means nothing, but we mistakenly translate it into its English translation. So let's replace the English translation with an icon that looks like this. Well, unfortunately, that icon never got placed. The word just instead got deleted. And I caught them deleting this word. And I disclosed how the design document that describes how they're going to delete it, and then also the implementation notes from the operators of the company as they're deleting us. Now, one of the interesting things that we've noticed is that the name of the team that was responsible for censorship was called Derrida Team. Now, Derrida Team is named after the philosopher Jacques Derrida, who advocated for the destruction of Western civilization through the manipulation of the definition of words. So how ironic is it that the team responsible for censorship would name their team after this one particular philosopher?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. I saw this, and I realized, wait a minute. You know, oh yeah, and then so after this word got deleted, a bunch of establishment mainstream media outlets made the case that because Trump was mentally unstable because he was tweeting nonsense, among other things that were happening in the news cycle at the time, because Trump was tweeting nonsense, that meant that he was mentally incapacitated, and that this justified invoking the 25th Amendment, Section 4, to remove President Trump from the presidency. When I saw this, I realized this is sedition at the very least. They're trying to remove a sitting president who is democratically elected from the office. Now I have to do something. I can no longer sit idly by and be like neutral while this sedition is happening, lest I become wrapped up in this as well, unless I become part of the conspiracy. And so if I want to make myself, you know, and clear, make myself right and clear my conscience, I had no choice but to go to law enforcement, go to the media, and reveal what Google was actually doing to the American public.
Mm. Oh, it's insane. What about your own problems after this? I mean, do you think that Google will press charges, or what do you risk actually with this disclosure?
Well, what's really interesting is that there have been other whistleblowers as well, and there was one whistleblower by the name of Kevin Cernacki. And Kevin's story is really sad because he did everything what he thought was the right way to go about it. So he carefully collected a bunch of documents, and he went to the state and federal labor boards and presented a write-up on how Google was systematically targeting conservatives within the company. Okay? Well, what Google did is they retaliated against him, and they brought him into an HR office. They grabbed his laptop, and then the network security guys went through the laptop, saw the documents that this guy had, which was over 2,000. And then what happened was they accused him of criminal misconduct. They fired him. They sued him. They tried to press some sort of criminal thing against him, saying that he hacked into their network so that he could discover their legal strategy. So it's basically similar to espionage. And so he got the book thrown at him, and he's still fighting that. And he's lost over $100,000 defending himself through the arbitration process in America. So he's not even allowed a court with a jury of his peers. He has to go through a fake court called arbitration, in which the arbitrator holds total power over what happens to Kevin Sternicki. So when you ask, like, what's going to happen to me, well, my assumption is that the same was going to be attempted to me. And I realized that if I were to remain silent in the face of Google discovering that I had collected all these documents, that the same fate would have befallen me. I would have been financially ruined. I would have had all my funds drained, as Google, with its infinite power and its infinite money, would drag me through every single court case and file frivolous lawsuit after frivolous lawsuit in the hopes that they could just get me to spend money on a lawyer and drain myself. What we call this is we call this lawfare. It's like warfare, but instead it uses the law.
Mm-hmm. But so actually, what's the current situation with you now? Don't you think you could face any charges still? What's the current process legally here?
I think I'm definitely at risk to facing charges. At any time, Google can start a lawsuit against me. I know that if I fight them primarily in a court of law, that I will likely lose. Instead, what I'm doing is I'm taking this as a fight to the court of public opinion. And so right now, I'm just waiting. I've already received a letter from them about a month ago demanding to know what happened to their data, what happened to their laptop, and demanding access to my computer and all of my backups so that they could go through and delete any information that they found on their computers and in my computers and in my data.
Your private.
My private information. Mm-hmm. I responded by letting them know that I had retained their data and that I had actually sent all of it to the Department of Justice Antitrust Division, along with their laptop, because it contained evidence of, you know, a criminal conspiracy of sedition. And so at that point, they ended up calling the police on me to do a wellness check. And when the police came, I didn't answer the door. And they escalated to the point of shutting down the streets from 20th and Valencia to 22nd and Valencia, evacuating the local stores in my neighborhood, calling in a bomb squad because they decided that a tin can filled with denatured alcohol that's used for fire dancing that my roommate does was likely a bomb. So they called in a bomb squad, and I eventually had to come out with guns pointed at me with my hands up in order to explain the situation that I was actually not planning on hurting myself or anyone else. That was the last time that I've actually had anything to do with Google, because what I hope is that by the fact that I've become public, by the fact that their information was turned into the DOJ, and by the fact that I've released absolutely everything that I held, now I hope that they're going to leave me alone. I don't know if they're going to leave me alone. It's entirely possible that they won't. It's entirely possible that I'll receive a letter today saying that the arbitration process has started and that I'll need to be dragged through this fake court and have my total finances destroyed. But the thing is that I think Google knows, and definitely the rest of America knows, that I'm not going to stop talking about Google's election interference. That's more important than anything else that what's happening right now, because elections are sacred and they need to be free and they need to be fair. And if Google's intending to meddle in elections globally, then this is something that I'm going to continue to talk about to the American public and to the people of Europe. And whatever Google does, I'm just going to leverage that and use that to amplify my message about what Google is really doing to our election systems.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Hi, Zach, by the way. It's Isaac here, the second reporter. I've been sitting here quiet, but listening with big ears.
Hey, Isaac. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you, too. In the interview with Project Veritas, you described it like a burden being lifted off of your soul. Can you elaborate a bit on what you meant by that?
What I saw Google actually doing across with its censorship and its election meddling, I started to feel a tremendous sense of guilt because I was being paid really well and I had a really comfortable life because of the income. And I felt that the income was buying my silence. And I felt, therefore, that I was complicit in this censorship and this election meddling. And it didn't sit well with me. It didn't feel right with my soul to be part of this really evil system. And I felt that the only way that I could alleviate the guilt and atone myself for participating in the system was to have full disclosure about what Google was doing.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a few episodes here earlier already, but I'm curious to hear a bit more about that. Were there some other experiences that pushed you in the direction of going public?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the thing that really turned me in this direction was when Susan Wojcicki in 2017 of June gave a speech describing what YouTube's new policy was going to be on fake news and authoritative content. Now, keep in mind that the mainstream media at this time had been running a Russia-Trump collusion hoax. And there was a lot of alternative media that were pointing out that this hoax was actually a hoax. And I saw the establishment media as having completely destroyed their own credibility by chasing something that was known to a large section of the population to be completely fraudulent. And now, if we fast forward to June of 2017, Susan Wojcicki is on stage at an employee meeting telling the company that the problem with the system – with the media system is that there's too much fake news, that there's too much fringe news, that what YouTube needs to do is be responsible and start pushing up authoritative content. And I'm asking myself, well, wait a minute. Haven't you seen that the press has completely lied to the American public, that it's the alternative news that's actually been consistently delivering the truth? Why are we trying to push them down and prop up these lying media establishment pieces that don't have any credibility at all in the minds of the American public? I thought that was a travesty. And for me, that was when I really started like digging. And I really started digging into like, okay, well, if they're going to protect us from fake news, then what exactly is fake news? And so after like this conference, I really got activated. I was like, okay, like, what the heck is fake news? Like, what's the definition? What does the company think? And so I started like searching on the internal networks that were available to all full-time employees what the definition of fake news. And I found a fake news presentation that was given to the given to the executive class. And the interesting thing about this is that they listed examples of fake news that were actually real events that happened. Okay, so let me give you an example. They were saying that it was fake news that Hillary Clinton was running weapons through Benghazi in order to arm ISIS terrorists in Syria. And I said, well, wait a minute. That happened. So why are they listing this as fake news? And so I was like, well, you know, what else are they talking about, right? And so it's fake news and it's hate speech and it's racism. These are the things that Google believes, you know, was the outcome of – it was responsible for Donald Trump getting elected. They think that it's something that they need to take control of, and they don't see anything related to the migration crisis as having produced any of this like negative sentiment that's existing out there on the internet. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a complete disconnect between the company and what the common person is thinking in their mind. And mm-hmm. So that's when I started digging in and started like really like saying, well, okay, well, if this is fake news, then what's the fake news system that they're going to use to suppress the fake news? And I started finding that. And that was like called Superroot. And I started finding, well, what's the real-time system that they're using on YouTube? Oh, that's called Twiddler. And so I started generating this like search ring that started getting wider and wider and wider of documents and systems. And I realized that because these people that work at Google were like, you know, the high ups, they were really like indoctrinated with the establishment narratives. I realized that they actually had no idea that what they were doing was this Orwellian nightmare of a censorship engine. And so I realized that in the future, they would realize, as documents started to get leaked, how damaging all this stuff was. So I was like, I have access to these documents now. I need to grab access, and I need to start grabbing them. So I just started doing this as much as I could, not knowing that I was going to leak at the time that I grabbed it. I just knew that I needed to have the documents because they wouldn't be available in the future. It wasn't until I saw the Covfefe thing that I realized, okay, I got to take these documents, and I got to give them to some entity. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, sure. And so you were collecting all these documents for a longer period, like for a couple of years or all the way back to 2016, right?
No, I started in 2017 because of the fake news issue. I was trying to figure out what the definition of fake news was. So I started in 2017 and it went all the way pretty much until 2018. By 2018, the documents started to get locked down as leaks started to come out. There was a real damaging leak of the all hands meeting at TGIF right after Donald Trump got elected. And what happened is that the Google executives were on stage talking to the employees, and they actually started to break down and cry because Hillary Clinton, the person that's had a lot of people die around her, and the person that, you know, helped destroy Libya and armed terrorists in Syria, this person didn't win the election, and they're so sad about it that they're crying in public. It's absolutely, like, embarrassing that they, that the people, the executives at Google, would display themselves publicly to the employees like this. And so this got leaked, and this got leaked through Breitbart News. And as a result of this, Google started to realize, wow, this is some of the stuff that we're having is kind of damaging once the normal people outside of the company see how radical we really are. And so, you know, I was grabbing documents because of this, and this lasted all the way into 2018.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, talking about how they fight fake news, etc. You went public on Project Veritas with your identity blowing the whistle on the 14th of July, being interviewed in a video published on the news outlet's YouTube channel. The main interview, the main video interview currently has around 631,000 views, and considering the magnitude of this leak and video report, it seems to be a very small number. And together with many of other critical videos on the platform, the range of the audience, the reach seems to be of a very limited. It seems to be very limited, even for videos that are not reported in a so-called limited state. Do you think that they are in fact prevented to become viral in any way? And how would such prevention work? I mean, the video interview with you should be maybe have 2, 3, or 5 million views by now, and it has just 600,000. Do you think it is limited by algorithm, or how is this performed actually?
You know, the way that it works is if there is fringe or trashy content, then it gets deranked. Google has been suppressing videos that feature me in it. I've called them out on my Twitter page. And what they do is that they suppress view counts and they suppress likes. And when people interview me, then all their videos end up going up for review and they get demonetized. So all their ad revenue gets taken away. And so Google is systematically harassing anyone that talks to me because they don't want this damaging information getting out. Now, if you look at all the video content across the different platforms, so you look at Twitter, you look at BitChute, you look at what people are talking about and rebroadcast of the video within different videos, what you see is that number is actually a lot closer to around 5 to 10 million people that have been reached by this video. It's actually a very significant number of people that have been reached. And so even though YouTube is doing the best they can – to suppress this content, this content is still getting out there. I know that Twitter is not necessarily banning me anymore. When I first started saying this stuff, I was shadow banned. But then recently, I found out that they had reversed that decision for some reason. And so I thank Twitter for allowing me to get the message out there. This is very important. And shame on Google for continuing censorship on the person calling out censorship.
Yeah. I would like to get more into detail about this algorithm, because perhaps it is controlling the details of this, the methods that they use to prevent videos to become viral. So, I mean, there is different methods they have. One is obviously the one that you called putting a video into a limited state. It means they are not listed. They're not counting the views. You cannot like it. You can't comment on it. So it's the most limited state you can have, except it being deleted. But, for example, so the video with you being published by Project Veritas, how do you think that is actually implemented? How do they prevent it to become viral? Because I think, do they maybe perhaps first flag a channel? So they're like monitoring some channels more than others, and then they put some turning down the percentage of the range, or how do you think it is implemented actually? Because it's it looks kind of organic when you look at it still, right? I mean, it has 600,000 views. Google can say that, look, it's not banned. Everybody can see it. It's like 600,000 people have seen it. It's not banned, right? How can you like describe this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the way that Google operates is that they don't just have one way that they suppress. They actually have like multiple ways that they suppress, and then they apply them all. So when you look at all of them together, you can't see like this one thing go, aha, this is how they're suppressing, because it's actually spread out, distributed in a bunch of different ways. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways is that they just suppress the view count, okay? Like we've seen view counts on videos featuring me get stuck for 5 hours, and then I call them out on Twitter and expose what they're doing, and then all of a sudden the view counts aren't going back up. That's one of the ways that they do it. Another way is that they de-rank a video. And so when people are searching for content, what happens is that other people's content, trashy people's content, goes to the surface, especially ones that are more aligned with the mainstream media narrative. And this has been complained about by several right-wing influencers like Paul Joseph Watson, where if you search for his content now, you won't actually find his video at the top. You'll see some small content creator with a small following, say like 3,000 followers, and he's made a video making fun of Paul Joseph Watson. Well, that video making fun of Paul Joseph Watson will go to the front, okay? And so this exact same thing is happening with Project Veritas video. It's hard to find the video. People can go and they can search, and this video is not going to be necessarily at the top of the search range. I'm sorry for using imprecise language here. Anything I say could be used against me in a court of law, of course. So, and I haven't done the query in the last few days, so I don't know exactly what page, but I know that I remembered that it was not where it should be, which is right at the top. Other people's videos were getting priority ahead of us. So this is another way that they do it, is by ranking other videos up and then ranking the content the user is trying to find actually really low. Let's say the third or the fourth or the fifth page. And so as a result, most people will stop at the first or second page of results. They're not going to go to the fifth or the 15th page in order to like get something. Right. Another way that they suppress a video is that they suppress the amount of likes. And the reason why this is really important is because a recommendation engine takes the number of likes into consideration for pushing the content out to a lot of people. And so if YouTube suppresses the likes on a video, then the algorithm won't treat it as something that is as important as another video. And then also another way that they suppress this content is that Google's search engine ranks certain content higher than others. So for example, there is a Daily Beast article, a hit piece about me, and that one is one of the top, it was the first, it might be the second now, But this hit piece from a completely disreputable news organization is pushed all the way up to the top. Why? Because they toe the same line that the establishment media narrative conglomerates are pushing, and therefore they get pushed to the top no matter how many times they've lied to the American people with their fraudulent conspiracy theories. And so taking all of these together, the suppression of likes, the suppression of views, the deranking within YouTube search, the deranking in Google search, this is how they prevent information from getting to the American people and to the rest of the world.
It's clear that the climate has been very polarized, and YouTube understands and Google understands that they are in the center of this process and how important their tools are. So I'm asking you, like, at the same time, it is obvious that many political activists is actually flagging content that they don't like, and they are mobilizing people to get like mass flagging to take videos and channels down. But do you think that is usually how it works, coming from like activists' network, mass flagging, or do you think that YouTube themselves are monitoring some channels more than others, like manually? And just, for example, I mean, you have Steven Crowder or other people that are by YouTube considered controversial, but they are not closed down yet. So, right, they can publish content, but it's obvious that they're like checking every piece of video that you put up on the platform to see what it actually contains, so they can like shut it down immediately if they find something compromising there. So, I mean, how do you think it works in Google? Because there's so much content going up. Do they have a large number of staff just monitoring manually a lot of channels to just prevent them going viral? Or how do you think it works?
Yeah, so there's a project called Project Purple Rain, which is staffed 24 hours with people. And all they do is that they monitor trends that are happening across the information networks of Google and YouTube, and then figuring out which information they want to push up and which information they want to push down. So absolutely. And if your audience wants to find out more information about the details of this project, the name of the project is Project Purple Rain, and they can find this information at projectveritas.com.
It's part of the meddling, what they're doing in this department, these people. Mm-hmm. So do you know the identity of these people? I mean, maybe you don't need to tell them here. It's just curious to know. Do you know who is in charge of this department, and do you know the identities of these people?
So it's a complicated question. The short answer is that a lot of the disclosures that I've given to the general public through Project Veritas has the actual names of the people, identifying information and also names of people that have been involved with this election meddling. And so when people go to a lot of these bug reports, then they can see the names of these people. So yes, I have given a partial disclosure. I can't recall any names off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is happening like now, it was like maybe a few times per year now, and then a few times per month. Now it's like every week they are closing down really big channels, deleting all their content. And many people, as you know, they make their living out of being a content creator on YouTube. They receive this standard mail like you have been violating our policy, and it's like you can make a complaint, but usually it's nothing happens. So with the information you have, do you think now there is any way for frustrated content creators to get in touch with Google? I mean, could you recommend any other way now, instead of like using Google's online forms, which we know it's like a firewall for them, not being like staying away from the users and the content creators? Now, do you think there is any other way content creators could use to get in touch with the company?
From what I've seen, they haven't really improved or made any changes to how they interact with their content creators. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't happen to be a big content creator myself on the YouTube platform, so I can't really give a lot of insight, other than I know what other people have said, and they said that it's still the same thing. They can't get a hold of anyone. YouTube is ignoring what they're saying, their grievances, and nothing's changed. Like, I expected that YouTube would change something in the way that they're working and going forward, but in reality, they've changed nothing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we know the identity, and even some emails were leaked, but perhaps there is no idea to use them for this purpose. I guess they would just ignore them anyway.
I mean, the only thing that I found that ever worked with inside the company is when someone has a large Twitter following and the Twitter followers all start complaining together that someone's channel got taken down or some video got removed. Only then will Google respond and take corrective action.
Mm-hmm. In the 950 pages leak of the documents you could show us, we couldn't find any European or Swedish domains in these blacklists. So I'm curious to know, do you think that they have divisions, for example, in Europe or Sweden, that are hosting the blacklist for their own region? Is it how it works, you think?
I believe that that's the way that it is. I believe that, you know, Google.eu is different than Google.com. On the other hand, if you look at the YouTube query blacklist, what you'll see within that blacklist is the censored phrase, the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution of Ireland. So the fact that they were blacklisting this constitutional amendment within YouTube indicates to me that there is some cross-American European, you know, crossover with mm-hmm. these search terms.
But the documents you were able to reach is exclusive perhaps for Google in USA, so it means that there could be other documents, other blacklists for Europe that you were not able to access at this time.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on exactly with Europe. I know that those offices are somewhat distinct from the US offices. Like, Google is a very large company across the world, and they have like silos with other countries. And, you know, I didn't investigate what was going on with Germany. I didn't investigate what was going on with Sweden, you know, and I didn't investigate what was going on with France. I just looked at the information that was available to us on the English American website, internal to all full-time employees.
Thanks for telling. Another big issue, I think, besides censorship and political bias, is the question about surveillance. So we just want to get into this topic briefly and your thoughts about this. So it seems that Google is wishes to gather information about everybody and everything. What is your thoughts about the surveillance aspect of Google?
So Facebook said that they didn't sell your data. But then after Cambridge Analytica happened, they were investigated. And it turned out they were selling your data to 68 large corporations and intelligence agencies. Now, if that's happening with Facebook, what are the chances that the same thing is happening with Google? Okay, we have a saying within Silicon Valley, which is, if the product is free, then you're the product.
Yeah.
And so if, you know, in terms of whether they're selling any of our data, I don't have any direct evidence of that. The only evidence that's out there is a lot of circumstantial evidence and assertions by other people. Mm-hmm. But if I was a betting person, which I'm not, I would place my bets on a large-scale data selling operation that's happening. In fact, that may even be their primary revenue source.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're aware about Edward Snowden's disclosure in 2013. And as I understand, one of the things he revealed was that several big tech companies cooperated with the NSA, And there is two things that I think is interesting there to mention. One is that when NSA first came to these tech companies and telling them that we need some data from you, they are not allowed to tell their users or the public about the fact that they even were there. There's some kind of law protecting, I don't know how it works in the US, but...
It's called a national security letter.
Yeah. So actually, that you can't complain. I mean, you can't blame Google for that or Facebook for that because they can't tell the users about that. The alternative for them is to shut their service down. But he actually revealed that these tech companies were at least at this time providing NSA and other intelligence agencies with data, not only like on demand, but in advance. This is the big thing that he revealed, basically. So, as I understand, they they have been implementing some kind of wiretapping system. So it means that the NSA or other agencies doesn't need to make a call to Google each time. They have kind of access to everything that goes through this system. So my question to you is, this were a few years, some years has passed. Many people say that this process haven't stopped. It's just more sophisticated. It's not so obvious anymore for the public to see it, perhaps. But still, this is people that you worked with, inside Google, that cooperates with NSA. On what level is this being? Is this happening? I mean, because if the NSA is wiretapping the data every day, within Google could be responsible for it, aware of it, and have provided like NSA, like go to this data center, connect your cables here. Like, do you have any idea like how this work practically within Google if it is still in operating?
If I had information about that, I wouldn't share it. And I want to make a statement about Edward Snowden and the NSA. Mm-hmm. The NSA is a data surveillance entity of the U.S. military. The U.S. military is probably a decade behind surveilling the citizens in comparison to the corporate surveillance apparatus. The corporate surveillance apparatus is absolutely gigantic, okay? And it's really interesting that the mainstream media loves to talk about the NSA surveillance collection techniques, but they don't talk about the corporate surveillance techniques, which dwarf the amount and size of the NSA. Okay, so I just want to let that be clear. Mm-hmm. The amount of corporate surveillance far exceeds what the NSA does. I don't see Edward Snowden in quite the same light as most other people. I don't venerate him as a hero. I see him as someone that was inserted from the intelligence agencies in Booz Hamilton in order to disable the NSA's surveillance network so that it could not compete with the, for lack of a better word, the CIA's surveillance network. However, the question about unfettered access that the NSA has, it needs to be questioned, and we need to have a discussion about what it can and cannot surveil. And I hope that we have that discussion. It's becoming obvious that surveillance is going to be everywhere. We cannot reverse this. We cannot put the genie back into the bottle. Mm-hmm. What we can only do is we can only choose the type of surveillance we have and who gets to ultimately see those eyes. In the old model, and the one that still currently exists, the globalists were able to see the information on everyone across all networks. Okay, and this is incompatible with security of the United States, because if China can buy the real-time information of every single person within the United States, then if there's any dissident that speaks out against China, then China can order a hit on that person and kill them. However, the United States does not have the ability to retaliate because China is a protectionist economy. They do not allow our industries to have any inroads, and therefore there is they have the ability to perform asymmetric warfare against the United States. And sorry, my I gotta plug this back in. You know, yes, Edward Snowden did tell the people about, you know, the NSA surveillance. I don't think that he's a hero like the rest of us do. I think that when if you peel back the layers and you look at where he really came from, you'll see that it was actually a hit job from the CIA to disable its competitor, the NSA.
Okay, but you still think it's the power remains within the government rather than the corporate? It's just an internal battle, I mean.
I would rather have the military doing the surveillance than some globalist mafia state. Okay, the U.S. military, by definition, cannot target citizens unless they are enemies of the state, enemy combatants living within the United States. In terms of the global mafia that exists, globalism, we have no control over who gets to see it. We don't even, in fact, we're not even having a discussion about what they can see. And that discussion needs to take place because it's a much bigger scandal than the Edward Snowden revelations on the NSA. They can see everything. And instead of sending a letter, they don't even send a letter. They just take the information. And then when people say, well, they could see everything, the establishment media tries to slander those people as conspiracy theorists. And so, you know, this is uncommon knowledge to most people, and I've discovered it through many, many hours of research of what the true surveillance threat is. And it's the corporate one, not the military one.
But so you, it seems to mean that the people who are like in charge of this has shifted, because before it was obviously within the NSA. So, I mean, so to actually what kind of people? Because, I mean, Google is like technical company. There's a lot of techniques and computers, but who are the actual persons? If you say it's not the people within the NSA anymore, that they are like looking into this data, that they're using it for detailed operations, who are the new people who have
Don't get me wrong. The NSA does get information, and yes, it is a problem, but it's not the main problem that is out there. The main problem is that there's this globalist force that is trying to infiltrate and dominate over all other governments. Like, you know, we went to war in Afghanistan, Iraq, and then we were covertly funding terrorists and ISIS to overthrow that country. You know, this is this infiltration by these globalists in order to destroy entire countries. This is the real threat. This is the thing that was controlling the United States military. And these people still have a large degree of control over the global population. And these are the people that are the real threats of surveillance. These are the people that have access to absolutely everything. And they don't send a very nice letter to any organization demanding information. They have it because they own the companies. They own the money system. They own the banks, and therefore they own the companies. What's a really interesting thing to realize is that corporations in America now pay out more to finance their debt to the banks than they do in, to their stockholders. So if you want to, you know, if you look at like the extraction of wealth that's going up to these banking empires, it's this large sucking sound, and they're sucking up money, they're sucking up surveillance, and this thing needs to come to an end. And this is truly the threat to the American people, and this is something that we need to protect ourselves from with an Internet Bill of Rights that clearly lays out exactly what information the NSA and the CIA and the various intelligence agencies around the world can access and share. And I believe that an Internet Bill of Rights would allow us to have data protection so that our data could not be sold to foreign adversaries. So our data couldn't be sold to countries like China that don't have our best interests in mind.
Yeah, for sure. It would be interesting to hear about what other media outlets have been in touch with you from like the more conventional sphere of media. Have anyone, I don't know, New York Times or Washington Post, have they made any report
they
whatsoever?
They won't even touch this. The only establishment news organization that's touched this is Fox News with an article that they had talking about the Project Veritas leaks. I don't know if they mentioned me or not. I don't think that they did. But the thing is that these leaks are so damaging, and they show so much election meddling and other deep state operations that my guess is that they are fearful. Because at this point, Google delivers a lot of traffic to Fox News. Fox News has an agreement with YouTube so that they get a lot of the customers that are searching for news. They get redirected to these establishment players. And so these leaks are so damaging that I believe that the other media outlets are fearful of exposing this, lest they threaten their own revenue source, which is customers being delivered by Google's platform.
That's at least the pattern in Sweden as well. It's been very quiet, to say the least.
Yeah. Perhaps it's very interesting. Perhaps we can get back to you later. But just last question I want to, before we round up here, it is about the future now. So because it seems more, it's obvious that YouTube become more and more political and biased, and we need more free and open alternatives. So what is your comment on the current competitors for YouTube and for Google? I mean, other video platforms and search engines, about existing ones, and what you think is needed to overcome for them to be a realistic alternative to Google and YouTube.
So Google's search engine has gotten so bad that I don't use it as my default anymore. I use StartPage, DuckDuckGo, Bing, Yahoo, and then I'll use Google. Okay? You know, the other search engines have gotten better, and Google's search engine has gotten worse. And so when you take those two together, it says, okay, well, the competitors are actually really, 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 really good right now. So I don't think that search engine is something as a political crisis. It's more of a cultural crisis. And as people start to move away, which they are right now, then they'll deny Google that search traffic. In other words, if they're going to censor us, then we're going to censor them. As far as YouTube is, the issue with YouTube is that it contains a massive database of information. It's got all these videos and all these archives that right now the competing platforms such as BitChute, Minds, Gab, oh, actually Gab doesn't do video as much, but these right alternative on. Video yeah. sites don't have the archive size, the database size that YouTube has. However, with these revelations, what's been happening is that BitChute, which is the popular alternative to YouTube, is actually gaining massive popularity at the moment, and a massive influx of users are starting to move over to the platforms. And my hope is that if there isn't a political solution to this, then just by the fact that people understand what Google's doing with their election meddling, they're going to realize that they need to transition. They need to transition to a different video platform. And so my hope is that, you know, I can help accelerate this process so that we can have a true diverse platform of free speech platforms that people can use in order to express their ideas.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. We are hoping for that.
And I appreciate you guys taking the risk to come out here and talk with me, because this information affects everyone on the planet.
Sure.
Yeah, the same goes for you. And we assume you have a busy schedule still. Enough media out there to talk to.
Yeah, I'm going through the influencers on YouTube that have like 40, 80, 100,000, 200,000 subscribers. So the word's getting out there. Everyone has pretty much heard about this by now, even if the mainstream media hasn't talked about it, which goes to show how important the alternative news stations are. They're really getting large.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We look forward to follow you closely, and all the best of luck.
Yeah. Great. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much.